It is yet another KVSH special. I am your host, Jeff Hoyt. Been a while since I've done this, but you know the drill. Every time I want to talk to somebody special, I turn it into a KVSH special. Today's guest, he's been here before. He is, of course, something of a legend here on the island. Singer, songwriter, musician. He works a lot of production out at his Puzzle Tree studio on Maury Island. And he's always working on something. And the latest thing he's working on is a live show at Vashon Center for the Arts. It's happening on March 30th at 7:30 p.m. So please welcome Pete Droege to the radio.
Hello.
Hey, man.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while. By the way, this is a VCA and Deborah Heesch Presents show. Tickets are going fast, and this show will definitely sell out if it hasn't already by the time we air this interview. Go to VashonCenterForTheArts.org and get your tickets before they're all gone. So, yeah, Pete, it's been a minute. How long since your last live show?
Last proper live show was the Chautauqua Music Festival in summer of 2017. I've played a couple sort of short set private charity house concert events since then, but the last proper show was 2017. And before
was the
show at VCA in 2016.
2016, that was my next question. So the last time you played at VCA 7 years ago, they didn't yet have those beautiful black curtains on the sidewalls.
That's right.
So you haven't had a chance to enjoy the splendor of the sound in there these days.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
It sounds great. I went to Pink Martini the other night, and there's like 13 musicians on stage, and I could look at each individual musician, and I could hear every single instrument.
Beautiful.
So let's start with why it's been so long since we've seen you on stage. Many of us in your world know this story, but others don't. You've had some health issues to deal with.
Yep. I've been dealing with chronic fatigue since September of 2015. And for a good period of that, it was pretty debilitating. I'm happy to report that now it's much more subtle than it was then. It's still an issue. These days, the fatigue might set in as early as noon or as late as 3 o'clock. And I wake up really early, so I get a good amount of productivity in before it comes on. And then I just have a nice routine now where I kind of have my self-care regimen. Where I just get horizontal and go to my meditation station, as I call it. And if I happen to fall asleep, don't tell the meditation police. But I get my rest in the afternoons, typically. And then the way things have been going recently, slowly improving, slowly but slowly, I tend to get some more gas in the tank for the evenings. And that's when Elaine and I have been having band practice for the upcoming show.
Excellent.
So, you know, much improved from how it was. I mean, there was a period there where I basically went into semi-retirement mode. You know, really put the brakes on pretty much everything.
Well, it's great to hear that you're back on your feet and creating again, and pretty much never stopped. You just had to slow down the pace a little bit. And you, like myself, who makes a living out of creating things in our home studios, were pretty much tailor-made for the challenges that the pandemic presented.
Yeah, and I was laying low anyway. You know, I was really taking it real easy. So the pandemic was not as much of a shift for me. Although when the pandemic began, I got really motivated. And we talked at that time when I was doing, when we released the single Skeleton Crew. And I had big highfalutin goals for trying to do like a fundraiser, well, kind of a project that would help musicians through that time when so many people had the rug pulled out from underneath them, especially touring live musicians. I had a project in mind where I was hoping to raise money for musicians, but I started working on that and the fatigue just got the better of me and I had to pull the plug on it. So there was a period there at the beginning of the fatigue where I got more active and then had to back off from that.
Well, that was admittedly a pretty big goal that you set there. Not surprised at all that that was a hard thing to realize. Maybe you can come back around to it at some point in the future.
Yeah, we hope to, you know, but it was good. We ended up with that single. We ended up raising a significant amount of money for Vashon Youth and Family Services, so it wasn't all for nothing. It worked out pretty well.
Did the pandemic affect your songwriting in any profound ways?
That's an interesting question. Not off the top of my head. No, I think
your day-to-day certainly didn't change all that much.
Mine didn't really change all that much, although it made it easier to, you know, I wasn't getting invited to parties that I had to sort of deliberate over whether or not to sort of try to make it out or not, you know. During the fatigue years, it was sort of very much, you know, I would, before the pandemic, it's like I'd want to go, but I'm like, I know if I go out to this party, I'm going to stay up past my bedtime and I'm going to be extra crisp for another day or two in the wake of it. So I just wasn't presented with the option of going out as often. So that made things a little bit more mellow. But as far as creatively, I can't really say that there was any real shift.
So this is also kind of a time of anniversary because your debut album, Necktie Second, turned 30 just this past year.
Comes up in May, actually.
Oh, it comes up in May.
Yeah, 2024 is the 30th anniversary.
Okay, so it's coming up. And this is also kind of around the time you and Elaine were really kind of getting together.
That's right. We met in January of 93.
Uh-huh.
And in March of 93, we traveled to South by Southwest together where we played a showcase. And that following Monday, we had multiple offers from major labels. And then that November, we were in the studio making the debut, Necktie Second, for American Records.
Oh, man. So those memories are forever intertwined.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really a great thing. And in the time that we were waiting to make the album and waiting for it to come out, we played a bunch of amazing shows. In fact, just today, we were looking at a bunch of old posters that we dug out of the closet and found a bunch of these shows. Like, we opened for Johnny Cash, we opened for Ricky Lee Jones, Lucinda Williams, a bunch of really great shows that we played around Portland at the time. So that was a super exciting time, you know, to get signed to a major label record deal and play all these big shows and get ready to make a real record was just really, really amazing.
I also recall from going through your Substack that you and Elaine, on very short notice, were asked if you wanted to open for Neil Young.
That's right. That was at that time as well. That was 93.
Holy crap.
Yeah, that was amazing. My manager, Kelly Curtis, and managers Kelly Curtis and Krisha Ogerow had sent my demo tape that I had recorded that was funded by Mike McCready from Pearl Jam, and I shared management with Pearl Jam's manager. And they had sent the tape down to Elliot Roberts, who was the legendary manager of Neil Young and others. And Kelly called that morning to kind of follow up to see, hey, did you get that tape? And they said, yeah. And if he wants to come to San Francisco tonight, Neil and Booker T and the MGs are playing an unannounced show at the Warfield Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got the call from Kelly just very dryly saying, how would you like to go to San Francisco tonight and open for Neil Young and Booker T and the MGs at the Warfield? And that was an easy yes. And I called Elaine at work, and her bosses, Sally and Steve at Showman Presents, kindly gave her the time off, and we flew to San Francisco and played that show. And then they asked us to stay for an extra couple days and play another show at a big outdoor shed called the Concord Pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to play two shows there in San Francisco. And then later, as the tour came through Portland, we also played a big, huge outdoor show with Neil and Pearl Jam and Blind Melon at a venue called Portland Meadows. I think there must have been about 25,000 people at that show. So this was super exciting.
Was that the biggest show you ever played?
At the time, that would have been the biggest. Yeah, before that, it would have been the Pearl Jam Drop in the Park concert, which was a free concert that they did in 1992, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Sort of right after their record blew up. Might have been, I think it was 92. Right when they had exploded, they actually had booked a show at a smaller outdoor venue, and then they got so popular that they had to move it to Magnuson Park. And that, I think, was at the time I played at 11 in the morning. I think there were already like 10,000 people there. And by the time the show was finished, they were playing for tens of thousands of people.
And of course, you and Elaine will be playing together on stage at VCA. And for the very small handful of people that don't know, we're talking about Elaine Summers here. You know her mosaic artwork from all over the island, which is just stunning. I've especially enjoyed over the last year in checking out your Substack, the little snippets of sessions where you guys were recording while you were sort of collaborating on a lyric or trying to work something out. And it just sounds to me like the perfect partnership.
It really is. Yeah, that's a fun series on the Substack, which we call From the Sketchbook. And I, you know, was brave enough to open up my work tapes and just share the, you know, these recordings that when you're doing them, you're just putting it down so that you can remember stuff. If you go, oh, what was that line you just sang a minute ago? You can always go back and listen. They're not really for public consumption. It's been interesting, you know, to share the songwriting process and kind of shine a light on how we do it. And yeah, it's a really fruitful collaboration. It works out great. In fact, just last night we had one of those sessions where we have a new song. Well, it's not too new anymore. It's been around for a while, but it's hasn't been released yet and hasn't been recorded. So it's still in flux. And there was one line that Elaine said, you know, I think the phrasing on that line is a little clunky. And so we've got about probably between 15 and 20 minutes of trying different variations of this one lyric, you know, and it's just like, try it, you know, starting right on the downbeat when the chord changes and put a couple extra words in, or wait for a bar and then have less words and work out all that phrasing. And so it's really super valuable for me to have somebody to bounce things off. Cause I, you know, I was just kind of happy with the way it was, but certainly where we ended up after her suggestion, we ended up in a better place.
So I want to get some songs in here over the course of this conversation. And just for the fun of it, let's go ahead and dive back in time to those early days when you guys were working on Necktie Second. The song Sunspot Stopwatch from that album is one of my favorite of all your tracks. And I wanted to play that here in a sec. And I was just curious where this song came from.
I actually wrote that song, you know, I just mentioned being at South by Southwest in 1993. I wrote that song while I was down in Austin, Texas.
Ah.
I can't remember why, but I was down there with Peter Blackstock, who's well known as a music journalist. He was the co-founder of No Depression magazine, and he wrote for the Seattle PI for many years and the Austin Chronicle. Great, great rock journalist and a great guy. And he really helped me to get down there. He paid for my flight to come down to South by Southwest that year and put me up while I was in town. And somehow I wound up at one of his friend's house in the afternoon on my own. And that's where that song was born. I think I might have finished it off later, but it began down in Texas.
Well, let's listen to it. Here's Sunspot Stopwatch on KVSH.
Sunspot stopwatch renegade savior stances. You say to take your chances, or else you break your branches as you climb to that top shelf tuna melt. Buckle up your seatbelt, Ricky Lee Jones, and everything that you think you own is fool's gold and ain't fossil stones. You got more than you need, but you need a lot more than some do. Look at your cigarette burn. The things that you can't undo if you try. Well, that's tough luck, King Tut, Daffy Duck never got old, babe. They'll bury you with gold, yeah. Is that enough to hold you for today? And I got to hand it to you. Why do you do what you do? It's times like this I'm glad that I ain't you. You think you got the devil on retreat, but he's back up on his feet and he's looking for you. Don't you see the lights, they're shining? Shut up and quit your whining. Four-star restaurants dining in the shade. Well, then your miniskirt'll hit the dirt, and baby, you'll be crying and bleeding. You'll bite the hand that's feeding, and then you're back there pleading for your soul. To hand it to you. Why do you do what you do? It's times like this I'm glad that I ain't you. You think you got the devil
Sunspot Stopwatch from Pete Droege off Necktie Second, an album that will turn 30 this coming May, and goes all the way back to those early days of Pete's career. The guitar on that track, it reminds me of a sound from around that time, and I'm wondering if there was any inspiration at all from Angelo Badalamenti from his scoring work on Twin Peaks. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. That was everywhere. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Yeah, he's amazingly talented.
Did you occasionally take inspiration from a new sound that was having a moment? Or sometimes those aren't really new sounds. They're just coming back around because they found the time and place to reemerge. But I wonder if little snippets like that or a sound or a feel from a certain era sometimes inspires your process.
You know, I'm sure it does. I can't think of it specifically with that song. I do remember recording that. I played that little lead figure on that song. You know, Brendan O'Brien, my producer, covered some of the lead guitar duties on that album. But in that case, I played that on his old Telecaster. I don't recall exactly what the inspiration was at the time for that. But certainly, I think more often than not, those kind of influences are unconscious.
Yeah.
You know, they just sort of emerge in the process of making records, you know. But there are times when you kind of, you know, will reference other records and kind of go, hey, let's go for, you know, something along the lines of fill in the blank. I can think of a recent example working on some of the new music with my, what I call the dream team in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Bellarose, who's an amazing session drummer, referenced the album by Bob Dylan called Desire that has a really interesting kind of drum sound to it. And my co-producer, Paul Bryan, and Jay kind of use that as a vague sort of reference point. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't sound too much like a copycat, but it sort of, you know, it points you in a direction, gives you somewhere to aim for, and then, you know, you end up sort of following your own path and it kind of becomes its own thing.
I want to move forward in time somewhat to another track that we're just about to play. And the first time I ever heard this, it was an instrumental strand in a documentary that you and I worked on together, Ellie Camaro's A Lot Like You.
Yeah. It actually preceded A Lot Like You. There was a short film that I scored called Touching Tiny Lives, and I had written that cue as an instrumental piece of finger-picked guitar with a little bit of electric slide guitar for that movie, and then ended up repurposing it for Ellie's movie A Lot Like You.
Uh-huh.
And then Elaine and I both, you know, we're fond of it and decided to turn that into a lyrical song. And then we wrote Two of the Lucky Ones as a result of that. And the genesis for that song came from a walk here on the island. And the lyrics are, as you hear, they're pretty literal. It's like, you know, standing on a hill, staring at a mountain, swallows dive and turn, trying to catch what we can't see. We just sort of said what we saw while we were on a walk.
And aren't we two of the lucky ones?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful Vashon evening, and that's sort of where the lyrics were born.
It is just a great song, so let's listen to it right now.
Is this the alternate version?
The one that you sent me.
And there's another version that's on the Droege and Summers Blend Volume 1, and that version was featured in the movie Zombieland, of all things.
Yeah, I was thinking, I need to go back and see that movie, because I saw that, and I remember coming across it at the time, but I need to go back and get the context of it.
Yeah, so that was more of an electrified version, and then this was, we decided after the fact, after we released Volume 1, we wanted to do more of an acoustic guitar-based version, and so that's what we're going to hear today.
Here's Two of the Lucky Ones, Pete Droege and Elaine Summers on KVSH.
Swallows dive and turn, trying to catch what we can't see. Sure ain't the first time, hope it ain't the last time. When all the work is done by the light of a setting sun, we see what we've become. wind is gonna blow. Trees are gonna sway in kind. Babe, I know you know. They don't have to try. Sure ain't the first time. Hope it ain't the last time. When all the work is done by the light of a setting sun, we see what we've become. Two of the lucky ones. The very first time, there's no words to be found. Opened up our eyes, there was love all around. Setting sun, we see what we've become. Two of the lucky ones. Standing on a hill, staring at a mountain.
Of the Lucky Ones, Pete and Elaine, their show at VCA happens March 30th at 7:30. This is a VCA and Deborah Heesch Presents show, and the tickets are going fast, so go to VashonCenterForTheArts.org and get yours before they're gone.
And they like may you said, be this... gone, I'll just jump in, they may be gone before this airs, so you can get on a wait list there, and if any tickets become available, if anybody has to back out, those tickets will become available. So if they are gone, you can call in and get on a wait list.
Good thought. Good thought. When that song wound up in Zombieland, there was a kind of a cool editing trick in the movie that many probably wouldn't recognize in the moment. It was kind of a blend between a Hank Williams song.
That's right.
Can you describe what was going on there?
Yeah, there's a scene where Hank Williams, I don't recall exactly which tune it was, is playing in the background, very faint.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of a nice weeping lap steel guitar. And then when they cut to the scene where our song plays, it just dovetails really smoothly from the slide guitar and the Hank Williams into ours. Like it's very transparent, the transition. And again, at the beginning of our scene, our song is really, you know, very much underscore in the background. And then as the scene progresses, it gets louder and more featured. And that moment was thanks to the music editor, is a man named Carl Kaller. And he's worked on a lot of big films. He's been Cameron Crowe's music editor for many years. And he was the person who was actually responsible for our song making it into that scene, because they had Sly and the Family Stone temped in there. And for whatever reason, they weren't going to use that song. I've always assumed it was maybe because Sly and the Family Stone maybe needed more money than they had in their budget or whatever. But for whatever reason, Carl was given a pile of music. I think that was told around 20 songs to consider for that scene. And he was the one who said, this song works in this scene. And he put it in there and made that music edit transition happen. And it's stuck in the movie. And there it is.
In regards to the song itself, Two of the Lucky Ones, it's a lovely song and just kind of demonstrates gratitude for having found each other and getting to enjoy, you know, standing on a hill together.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you guys, I know Cindy and I have thought about this, have you ever wondered about the what ifs that, you know, what if this didn't happen? If that hadn't happened, would we have ever found each other? You know, are there moments like that, and going back to when you first met, where if this didn't happen or that didn't happen, then you might not have ever crossed paths? And do you ever think about that?
I do. And I'm pretty certain that we would have crossed paths, because the music scene in Portland, Oregon in 1993 was very, very, very small.
So it was just inevitable.
We actually almost met on the first night I moved to town.
Really?
So when I first arrived in Portland, I was staying at drummer Greg Williams' house. Greg played drums and toured behind the Necktie Second album. And when I arrived at Greg's house, he was getting ready to go on tour, and I was going to stay in his room for a few nights while he was on the road. And in the living room was his brother Brent, listening to Elaine's music and working up bass parts because he was going to go sit in with Elaine at a club gig.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me to the show. And I declined because I already had plans to go to blues jam night at a club down the street. And then it was just like 3 nights later, I think, that we met at the opening of a club. It was actually the living room, which was a smaller venue above the legendary Portland club La Luna. And this was like an industry-only private party for folks in the local music scene to celebrate the opening of the living room. And that's where we met.
So it was going to happen one way or another.
I think so. Yeah, I really do. I think, you know, it was just a small enough scene that we would have crossed paths eventually.
Well, you guys, your voices sound so great together. And I think back to when I ran a creative services company. I was the creative guy. I did all the writing. My partner was the producer. He did all the production. I would invent the idea and then leave plenty of room for him to create something within it using his production skills. How is it with songwriting? When you and Elaine sit down to write together, is there a clear delineation of specialties? Like, you've got this, she's got that. Anything like that going on?
More often than not, the original musical seed will come from me.
Mm-hmm.
There's exceptions to that, but more often than not, I'll come up with whatever musical figure on the guitar, and I'll oftentimes have the melody kind of taking shape and maybe some lyrics. Where we really roll up our sleeves and get collaborative is in the lyric and the melody refinement department. So once we kind of have that roughed into place, we start working on the lyrics and the melody, and also sort of backing up to the sort of wide view of, like, what does the song want to be about? That's oftentimes very collaborative as well, where if I'm left on my own, I'm content oftentimes to write somewhat cryptic, obtuse, sort of vague lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And Elaine will kind of steer things towards, well, what is this song really about? And how can we find out what the center is, or what is the core of the song? And how can we have the lyrics really support that core? And then we really work together on fleshing it out together.
Well, this brings us, of course, to the Drosian Summers Blend, which is the collaboration you guys have been working on for a number of years. Volume 3 was released in November, complete with a video directed by VOV's Island Eclectic host, John Jeffcoat. Will you continue to create under the Drosian Summers Blend name, or does Volume 3 feel like, you know, things come in three, we're done with that?
I think Volume 3 is the completion of the Drosian Summers Blend. Partly for business reasons, you know, it's like the Pete Droge name, there's a lot more people who are familiar with that. And so when people are curious about what I'm up to, they're going to go to favorite streaming service and look up Pete Droge. And it was frustrating for years that people, my fans who would come to see what I was up to, the Droge and Summers Blend albums wouldn't even show up on my discography.
Oh,
and so the way we remedied that is we put all three Droge and Summers Blend volumes 1, 2, and 3 together as Pete Droge and Elaine Summers, the Droge and Summers Blend Sessions, volumes 1 through 3. So that's now available. If you find me on streaming, you'll find all that music now. So I think, you know, for now, what I'm working on next, I'm going solo, as they say, and kind of returning to just making a Pete Droge record. And so far, it's just worked out that it wasn't really a deliberate choice, but the songs that I've worked on so far with the new material haven't really been harmony driven. So there's three so far that are in the can that don't feature Elaine on vocals, although she's still contributing as a co-writer on most of those and general collaborator.
Well, let's get to a couple of tracks from Drosian Summers Blend, Volume 3. How long had you lived on Vashon when you wrote Island?
Ooh, good question. Let's see. We moved here on Halloween of 95, and we probably wrote that somewhere around 2008. So you do the math. 13 years? We were very much in love with the island by the time we wrote that song and felt very at home.
Well, it's a glorious song. Every once in a while, a local artist will write a song that is some kind of tribute to life on the island, and this was as good as it gets. It made me think about island life. It takes an adjustment in expectations around what time means, services, what's available, and what isn't. Lots of things. And my experience watching people come and then later leave Vashon was that the moment of truth happens about a year in, maybe 2 years in.
Yep.
And if you get past that, you're good to go. When did you guys know that Vashon was a keeper for you guys?
We rented a place for about 6 months before we bought our house.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of knew it was going to work out for me because I grew up over on Bainbridge Island. So I kind of had a sense of what island life was like. And
you were a grizzled veteran.
Yeah, the magic words for us when I was, you know, considering buying a house, we were actually originally thinking about Woodinville because we had worked at Bear Creek Studio up in Woodinville.
Oh, right.
And that was the dream. They had a, you know, a beautiful barn studio on 10 acres in the woods. And I thought, oh, that's what I want. And I told my friend that, and he said, well, have you been to Woodinville lately? I said, no. He goes, oh, man, it's all subdivisions. It's turning really suburban. What you ought to consider is Vashon Island. And then he said the magic words were, which Vashon Island is like Bainbridge was 25 years ago. And I did the math, and I remembered what Bainbridge was like back in the 70s when I first moved there as a kid.
Uh-huh.
And that really appealed to me. So we ended up renting a place here. I was confident that it was going to work for me, but I wasn't sure if Elaine could handle island life. And so we rented a house for about 6 months before we bought this place. And she fell in love with it instantly and never looked back.
Yeah, that's our story as well. I mean, you know, without the music. But
yeah.
it was pretty instantaneous. Let's check out Island from Drojan Summer's Blend, Volume 3 on KVSH. That is Island, and that was Pete Droege and Elaine Summers. Their show is coming up in March, March 30th, at Vashon Center for the Arts at 7:30. Another track from that record is Big Time Dream, and I want to play that as well and then ask you a couple of questions about it. So we'll just go kind of back to back here. Here's Big Time Dream from Pete Droege and Elaine Summers. Time Dream, KVSH, Droege and Summers Blend, Volume 3, that's Pete and Elaine. And I particularly resonated with that song because it kind of works with dreams at almost any level, really. I mean, you're talking about your music career, but do you think about the variability of interpretation that comes with writing lyrics?
You know, people always talk about how the personal and the specific can become universal.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I really spend much time consciously pursuing that. I think so much of the effort is in just trying to remain truthful, and just the craft of it really steers a lot of the process of songwriting. So just finding those rhymes and finding the word that sings right and flows off the tongue, these days anyhow. I think maybe in the past I might have spent some energy thinking like, let's try to make this relatable somehow, but that's not something that I concern myself with these days. I just try to kind of be truthful and stick to the heart and soul of what the song is trying to say.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why it was so fun to hear these songs being built through the session takes that you put up on Substack. Like on Big Time Dream, the bridge was that you were working with was, I move on, I stand still, now I finally got some time to kill. And then you kind of worked it and worked it, and that turned into, I move on, I stand still. Why does it always feel like going uphill?
Yeah.
Which worked, I think, way better. And rhythmically and conceptually as well.
Thanks, yeah.
Tell us how to get to the Substack.
It's very simple. You go Pete Droege, PeteDroege, .substack.com. And that brings you to the main page where you'll be asked to subscribe, but you don't have to subscribe to sort of dive in and look at all the material. You can just click no thanks and it'll take you in. It's sort of like a blog at that point.
Yeah.
But if you want to receive everything in your inbox, in your email inbox, you can punch your email address in there and for free become a subscriber. Or you're given the option also to become a paid subscriber, like mm-hmm. my friend Jeff Hoyt here. Thank you, Jeff, for your support.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And paid subscribers get some perks like the ability to download the tracks that we share. So those rarities like the From the Sketchbook work tapes and some of the demos that we share and all of that stuff. Paid subscribers can go to a secret link and download those for themselves to keep. And they also get access to new music before it's released. And then paid subscribers also enjoyed early bird tickets. So a lot of our paid subscribers are going to be smiling faces right up in front at the Vashon show. So we're excited about that. So that's kind of how Substack works.
We got time for one more song. And this one is kind of a new record. I don't know when you started working on Fading Fast, but the first time I heard it was over the course of the last year on Substack. And as you were writing about this, you were struggling with the song, as you put it, being too vanilla Americana.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had this epiphany when you went from a drum loop to a drum machine, and it got you all excited about the song again. Talk about moments like that, when a song suddenly comes into focus.
Yeah, that was a fun post to create because it really shows the evolution of how a song, once it's written, sort of finds its life as a record.
Mm-hmm.
And the first version that I put down of that song was like a fingerstyle guitar. And I put that down, I did a vocal, and I didn't spend a ton of time on it. And I kind of was unexcited by that, and I put it away. And then I did another version where I played a drum loop on a regular old vintage drum kit. And then I added bass and guitar to that. It was sort of a strummy guitar. And that was the one that I decided was sort of what I called vanilla Americana. It was just a little bland and boring sounding. And then I went back and I revisited the finger-picked acoustic version. And I recognized that the vocal was really solid and the guitar sounded cool, but it just kind of needed a little oomph. And so since I had cut it to a click track, which is like a metronome in the computer, mm-hmm. I was able to just put a little drum machine in there. And suddenly the track just came to life and felt like it was the bones of a record. And that's when I decided to take that version of the song and send it down to the Dream Team in Los Angeles and have Jay Bellarose, Paul Bryan, and a keyboard player named Lee Pardini add their parts to it, and that's what became the record.
It's a great song. Let's hear it now. Fading Fast. This is Pete Droege on KVSH.
Never gonna feel it all the way. It's all never say. I just can't stand to say goodbye. So I'll see you down the line. Truck stop, shivering at the payphone wall. My manager says that my single's been dropped and my sales are beginning to stall. They want me to do more interviews. I say please, my voice is shot. I'm trying to save it for the show tonight, 'cause that's the only thrill I got. Though it's
is Fading Fast from Pete Droege here on KVSH. This song recalls those 90s road days watching the cornfields pass. When you wrote about that, I got me curious because I wonder if you ever just, when you're back on the road in those Midwestern towns going past all those cornfields, which I remember, of course, from my days growing up in the Midwest and long road trips, and the cornfields would have that kind of strobing effect as they go by.
Mm-hmm.
And that would just pull me all the way down into myself. And I just wondered if you just ever found yourself gazing out at those cornfields and zoning out into daydreams or ideas. Did that have that effect on you?
Yeah, it's very romantic,
mm-hmm.
that life on the road, and especially those early tours in the 90s. In fact, I've got boxes of videotapes of just roads flying by, you know, roadsides flying past. I just recall just buzzing with the feeling of like, this is happening, I'm doing it, I'm on the road, you know. That's just that excitement was really significant in those days. There's just nothing like the allure of being on tour.
Well, it's going to be a great show, and I really cannot wait for March 30th, 7:30 at Vashon Center for the Arts. It's a VCA and Deborah Heesch Presents show. Tickets are going fast. If you are unfortunately too late, at VashonCenterForTheArts.org, you can put yourself on a wait list. You're working on a new album with the Dream Team.
Yep.
That will be coming out. Do you have an idea yet? Or
no idea. Okay. Slowly but slowly, we're pursuing that. And the process is, I like I did on Fading Fast, I do my tracks here in my studio,
mm-hmm.
and then I send them down, and then we're able to work remotely where I can actually tune in and listen to what they're working on in their studio in high fidelity and in pretty much real time.
Excellent.
And so I can chime in and get my production notes in there. But we're doing just like a couple songs at a time, very mm-hmm. slowly. And I've got a bunch of work that I'm doing to get ready for the Necktie Second, which we're hoping for a deluxe version of Necktie Second to celebrate the 30th anniversary. And so I'm working on some acoustic renditions of songs from that to round out what hopefully will become a double vinyl version of that album.
Ah, fantastic.
So a lot of my effort this year is going to be to getting the Necktie Second Deluxe happening. So really no plans for that record. We do have a single coming out. One of the songs that will be on the album is called Lonely Mama.
Oh, you're going to have that available at the show.
That's right. Yeah. As long as the vinyl production happens fast enough. It's a 7-inch single that's coming out on Mike McCready's Hockey Tuckter Records.
Mm-hmm.
And we're presuming that that's going to be ready in time for the show.
Excellent.
And so that'll be released in March, we hope.
So there is new music and old music to look forward to, and Substack, you just celebrated your 1-year anniversary, building subscribers, and I assume you're going to stick with that?
Yes.
Yeah, good.
Yep. I'm having a blast with that. It's been really, really fruitful. I really enjoy it.
Well, it's great to catch up with you, Pete, and so looking forward to the show.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.